So we have time for questions, and I guess I'll be the person to field them. Gentleman right here. If you wait for the mic and then hold the mic horizontally. Right here.
For all of the members of the panel.
And if you keep your questions short, please.
Do any of you think that the United States government is ignorant of the increased risk and costs and other downsides for the citizens of its imperial policies?
Want to start?
Well, I think some policymakers are in denial about that and don't think about it. But also, we have to remember that the government itself has an interest in many of this, and the government's interest may not be that of the citizens. I mean, we have to think about that. I mean, we have vast bureaucracies in Washington who drive weapon systems. Like the Pentagon does the threat assessments for its own weapon systems. So that's kind of a conflict of interest. We have all sorts of bureaucratic things going on there. So I think not only had they not thought about this, but there are a lot of vested interests being driven by high defense budget, active foreign policy. Because if you don't have an active foreign policy, you can't justify such a big defense budget, and therefore a lot of defense contractors and that sort of thing you know, will have to downsize, et cetera.
I don't think it's a question of ignorance or knowledge. First of all, I would put the emphasis not on bureaucracy in Washington, but on corporate influence in Washington. George Shultz, my colleague at Stanford and fellow at the Hoover Institution, former chair of the board of directors of Bechtel, was asked after Bechtel got the $680 million contract to reconstruct Iraq, didn't he think it was odd or a conflict of interest that he had also been the chair of the advisory council of the Council to Free Iraq, which was promoting the war, and then Bechtel profited from the war. He said, no, nobody thinks about it that way. And that is exactly the problem. Not enough people think about it that way. When we start to understand that the power in Washington is in the hands of corporations, and they are doing just fine from this war, whether Iraq becomes democratic, whether it increases or decreases the threat to our national security, Kellogg Brown and Root, Bechtel, the oil companies that are going to get a share of Iraq's oil industry, which is slated to be privatized, those folks are going to do just fine. Their interests are taken care of.
Yeah. Just a quick, I don't think they're ignorant. They have too much information for that. But, and some of them may be in denial, but I think most of them, it's mostly a matter of a different definition. They've got a different definitional framework on these issues, and they think that they're right.
You might say that the to sort of indirectly rephrase the way Adam Smith would describe so-called mercantilism is that you socialize the cost and you privatize the benefit. The lady right there.
Thank you. If we were successful in having regime change in Washington, what would you forecast for the short-term foreign policy benefits to undo some of the damage that has recently been done? Anyone on the panel?
I'll vote for you.
I don't think that there is an electable candidate for 2004 who could carry out the changes that would be required because they're very broad-reaching. I'm a big fan of those out there. I'm a big fan of Dennis Kucinich, who's said, among other things, that he would establish a Department of Peace, which I think is a good thing. I think another thing that needs to be done is that the United States needs to impose a settlement on the Arab-Israeli conflict. No one out there is really going to do that, although Kucinich has come close to saying that he would. But I think these things are far beyond what any of the electable presidential candidates are prepared to do.
Well, I would just say I agree with Joel on a lot of things, but I don't support a Department of Peace, because if it's anything like the Department of Defense, it would probably be misnamed, and so I'm not sure that it would be used for peaceful purposes. But more realistic assessment of the Iraq situation, I think would be good. And I think what we really need to do is we need to get out of there as quickly as possible, because I think things are deteriorating, and I think we need to turn this over to a coalition of the willing who can get a government run by Iraqis in there. And frankly, they've put us in a very bad position as policy analysts, because they've taken a very destabilizing act, and then everyone asks, well, the war's over now, can't criticize the war anymore, so what do you do now? And you're sort of asked to pick up after the horse when it goes by. But I think the ultimate solution in Iraq, I'm afraid, the natural solution is for Iraq to break up, and I'm not sure that we're going to be able to avoid that in the future, so we might as well allow the various groups to have self-determination right up front.
Yeah. Despite Senator Kerry's usage of that phrase, regime change in Washington, it's not likely to happen. But were you to have Governor Dean or Representative Kucinich, conceivably you'd have a little shift, or if they had a Pat Buchanan clone in the GOP, but I don't think any of those are likely.
Okay. I want to pick up on something Ivan said, and he was expressing some hope that over time the public would turn against this imperial policy. The public loves war, especially short, successful wars. You see all these flags flying around? People love it. The media loves it. Boy, was it CNN got good ratings and Fox got good ratings, and the public loves it, and they loved all these wars as long as they're short and successful. And that's why none of the Democrats, or none of the serious Democrats, are really running against the war. You can't run against something that's that popular. The polls still show, they say, oh, we don't care that they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, but we won the war. We beat the enemy. It's like playing your home team,
Tom,
beat the other side.
Do you have a question?
Comment.
Gentleman right here, Benson.
Wait,
Benson.
Reports in the past week that we went to war over the threat of using euro for the base of the oil market as against the dollar. One Hussein supposedly, according to the article, was threatening to convert from the dollar to the euro, and my understanding is Venezuela now is also threatening the same thing. Did we go to war to protect the dollar and preserve our supply of oil?
It is true that several OPEC countries have been discussing transferring pricing of oil from dollars to euro for some time. I don't believe that that was the main motive of the war. I don't believe that Iraq's oil was even the main motive of the war. I believe we went to war because we could win. In other words, it was a demonstration effect.
General
Ryan. I had a question for Ivan Erland. You drew a comparison between Albright and Clinton and their attempts in Bosnia and what's going on in Iraq today, and said that the main difference in presentation was that the government then had presented Bosnia as a humanitarian effort, and today it's talking about it as a defensive effort. But that's really not the case. There weren't similarities there. But
question?
The question is, as far as, and you said Rwanda was the other big humanitarian effort that was abandoned during Clinton era, but you haven't mentioned at all what's going on in Congo and something like 4 million people who've died there under this president's watch.
Well, I'm not defending George Bush or anything else. I just think that, and I wasn't really comparing the two necessarily. My purpose in saying that was Bush, to some extent, has used humanitarian reasons for going into Iraq. He wants to democratize. He wants to get rid of a brutal dictator. But he started off with strategic threat things. But my point is most of these humanitarian interventions, whether they're done by a Republican or a Democratic administration, you dig below the surface and it's not humanitarian at all. In fact, in the case of Bosnia, one of the largest, if not the largest, example of ethnic cleansing was by the people that were on our side, the Croatians. We did most of that because we regarded the Serbs as being aggressive, and we wanted to contain the Serbs. So I'm not sure that humanitarian considerations in any of these things are any more than rhetoric on whether it's a Democratic president or a Republican president that does it. They're more done for realpolitik reasons. Certainly, there's a humanitarian problem in Congo, and no one's proposing military intervention there. So that's another illustration of my point. We only seem to focus on the humanitarian rationale where there are other interests in at work.
Gentleman right back there.
Does our government have a legitimate right of hot pursuit or lukewarm pursuit of terrorists who are supported by governments, either officially or unofficially?
I think you could argue that such a right exists, which makes a big distinction between the attack on Iraq, which was unprovoked, and the attack on Afghanistan, which you could say was provoked because of the Taliban regime's harboring of Osama bin Laden. Having the right doesn't mean it ought to be exercised.
I agree with that. I think that in most cases what you want to do is rely on the host government to try to apprehend the people. And if they don't do that, then you may have to take other actions. But you should. I would use the military option last. I would rely on law enforcement and intelligence cooperation with other countries and their governments first.
Also, in the Constitution, as a reflection, getting back to what Ivan was saying in his talk about the views that Madison had, at least at that time, was that in the Constitution, Article 1, there's a provision where Congress can issue so-called letters of marque and reprisal. And the idea, the theory of that was that they would issue more targeted privateering efforts at terrorists or private piracy, essentially, at that time, were viewed as threats without engaging in some sort of foreign conflict, which most of the founders were against and were quite fearful of, because the last thing they wanted to do was to go to war with a European power.
The attack on September 11th was kind of a subtext for the attack on Iraq, supposedly retaliation. But do any of you know why Andrews Air Force Base, which is only 10 miles from Washington, and is there specifically to defend Washington, that no planes were sent from it? Instead, they were sent from in Virginia and Otis Air Force Base in Massachusetts, you know, over 100 miles away. That makes no sense to me.
I don't believe there were any squadrons there at the time.
My question is, are any of the panel members aware of the tremendous evidence in the public record of premeditation by the Bush administration in 9/11, foreknowledge and cover-up? And I'll just cite a couple of specifics real quickly. Number one, the fact that Osama bin Laden was treated at a U.S. military hospital in the Middle East 2 months before 9/11. The fact that the head of Pakistani intelligence wire transferred $100,000 to Muhammad Atta 1 week before 9/11, and during 9/11 was in consultation with the President of the United States and leaders from both the Republican and Democratic Party. The fact that Osama bin Laden's family members who didn't evacuate New York City prior to 9/11 during a national no-fly ban were evacuated by the U.S. Navy. I can go on. I've got 100 items like that I can give you.
I'm no fan of George Bush, but I don't put a lot of stake in conspiracy theories like that either. I'm not sure that all of those are actual facts. I know that those allegations are circulating around, Most of them have not been proven. I know that they are in the public record, meaning they're published by newspapers and so on. That doesn't mean they're true.
Oh, really?
I mentioned the episodes during the...
Ask George Bush about how in the hell the Osama bin Laden family has bankrolled his company. And he's been in bed with those suckers for years.
It's true.
You can't find Osama because they told the bin Laden children, cut the shit out. That's family. I don't want to hear this dumb shit. I'm so pleased that you're sitting here talking to us like intelligent people and not knowing the Bush and the bin Ladens have been in bed for years.
It is true.
When it talks about these people walking out there and flew out,
please.
I have to be able to pay that. Okay, I don't care what you're being to pay for.
It is true that the bin Laden family was in business with the Bush family through the Carlyle Group and so forth. And allegations that are presented in different media and elsewhere, of course, are things that are worth investigating. But as I mentioned in my short remarks earlier about the Spanish-American War, what you read in the newspaper may be true, it may not be true. Gentleman right here.
Yeah, I have a question for Professor Olson. The Pentagon recently announced some troop redeployments in South Korea that were explained as a measure that would make them more effective in launching a preemptive attack against North Korea. I'm wondering how much stock we should put in this explanation by these Pentagon officials, and also to what extent would South Korean officials acquiesce in further U.S. belligerence?
To my knowledge, that's not quite the way they explain why they're rearranging the forces there. What they've done is basically to make them more usable and more flexible. One of the suspicions is that by pulling them further away from the demilitarized zone, it may enhance somewhere along the lines the viability of a preemptive strike against North Korea, because in the North Koreans' reaction to what the U.S. is about to do reinforces that view. But that's not officially what they're doing. What they're doing is part of a larger worldwide rearrangement of U.S. forces. And the South Korean government has not been terribly happy with this, because the current government in South Korea, when he was elected, there was a lot of anti-American sentiment, and there was quite a bit of resentment against the U.S. forces in the vicinity of Seoul. The fact that the Bush administration is now changing it for other reasons, the current Korean government has backed away from their former position. So the South Korean government and the North Korean government are actually more or less on the same page in not wanting the U.S. to do it too quickly. For very different reasons. So they've got some difficulty in coordinating a policy between the two Koreas. But to my knowledge, they've never explicitly said that that's why they want to do it.
Bella, the gentleman right.
I would like to follow up a bit on this current discussion between South Korea, North Korea, and the United States. I think one of you mentioned earlier that Japan possibly was considering some kind of a preemptive strike against North Korea, and I wonder just how realistic is something like that given the history of Japan and the Koreas. It would seem to me that if anything like that even seemed possible, that would serve to unite, as far as I'm concerned, a good thing. To unite the two Koreas.
Yeah, most of it's Japanese rhetoric, and it's essentially part of the internal Japanese defense debate. I don't think there's any chance of the Japanese actually attacking preemptively or otherwise North Korea. It's mostly rhetoric it's part of their arguments in some conservative circles in Japan for having Japan become a more normal country, as they put it. So I think you're right that if the Japanese ever did something like that, you'd end up with the South Koreans and the North Koreans having considerable solidarity in opposition to the Japanese doing something like that.
We have time for one more question.
Good evening. I'm very impressed with the panel this evening. I know how there's usually very little collusion before a panel is like this. So it's rather interesting that you've had this range of opinions on this particular topic. My area of expertise is in the promotion of human rights and humanitarian aid and those sorts of things, and I follow very closely the Bush administration and the Clinton administrations, and especially the Department of Defense's efforts in portraying itself as a humanitarian aid force. They make considerably effective arguments that they can deliver humanitarian aid, for example, in large quantities to war-torn areas. My question is, given that they can do that, they can move men and materiel, personnel and materiel, so quickly, why do the panelists think that there continues to be a lack of resolve in putting such personnel and materiel on the ground in the Gaza Strip, for example, and directly addressing what one of you identified as one of the root causes for Middle Eastern turmoil, which is in effect the Israeli-Palestinian problem? It's certainly, if not a causal factor, it's certainly an excuse by, for example, Islamic fundamentalists. So why are successive administrations, Democratic and Republican, not dealing with just, you know, putting themselves, sort of interposing themselves in there?
I guess that falls to me. There are two reasons. First, any American administration that wanted to do anything with regard to Israel and Palestine that an Israeli government would oppose, and any Israeli government would oppose that kind of a move, is going to have to lose, put on the line, and risk losing an enormous amount of political capital. Congress is very, very powerfully in the grip of the Zionist lobby, which is far broader than the organized American Jewish community. It includes even more powerfully the defense industry and the Christian right. And secondly, even if a president were willing to risk the political capital to do something that Israel would powerfully oppose, it would mean diminishing the ability of the United States to collaborate with Israel on military and strategic matters in the Middle East, which are very important. Who, after all, trained American Marines for going into dark alleys in crowded Arab cities in Baghdad? That was the Israeli military. Who provides military intelligence for the Arab world for the United States? The Israelis. So the Israelis play a very important geostrategic role, and if the United States wants to continue a policy of empire in the Middle East, we need them.
Ivan, anything? Okay. I'm afraid we're over time, and I want to thank everyone for joining with us. I want to thank our three speakers in particular for their excellent talks. One last point I want to mention is that each summer we also conduct summer seminars for high school and college students, and if you have children or friends who have children that would benefit from a week of being involved in a program like this, we highly encourage you to do so. Carl Close is standing at the back as the director of it, and I'm sure he'd be happy to speak with you. Again, the three books that we're featuring here, we strongly recommend that you get copies, and I'm sure that each of the speakers would be delighted to autograph copies. There are copies upstairs, and thank you all for joining with us. We hope to see you at our next event. Good night.